Welcome to the Science Podcast for August 31st, 2012. I'm Edward Hermy.
And I'm Sarah Crespi. This week, aerosols and cloud formation in the Amazon, antibiotic-resistant bacteria in the soil, and a milestone in human anthropology.
The exciting breakthrough is that researchers have sequenced the genome of an ancient girl. She was a different kind of human, an archaic human, who lived in a cave in Siberia more than 50,000 years ago.
Plus, a few stories from our online daily news site.
Support for the Science Podcast is provided by AAAS, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, advancing science, engineering, and innovation throughout the world for the benefit of all people. AAAS, the Science Society, at www.aaas.org.
Particles of Earth float up into the atmosphere and serve as the nuclei around which clouds and rain form. The density of these particles in the atmosphere affects where clouds and rain occur. Soot and other anthropogenic aerosols are now found in almost all parts of the Earth's atmosphere, influencing global rainfall patterns. Meinrad André and colleagues are trying to understand the dynamics of non-anthropogenic aerosols in pristine air by studying aerosols over Amazonian forests. He spoke with me about the relationship between clouds and forests.
We're sort of on a quest for the pristine atmosphere. In other words, it's very difficult nowadays on Earth to find a place that is not already polluted by human industrial emissions. And one of the few places that resembles, at least some of the time, some of the place, a pristine atmosphere is actually the Amazon basin, especially in the wet season.
So what did you actually find when you were looking at the air in the Amazon?
Well, for one, that actually the particle number concentration is quite low. It's not dramatically higher than even over the remote oceans, so that apparently nature maintains in its pristine state an atmosphere with a relatively small concentration of particles, which was in contrast with what some people had assumed beforehand, that there would be a large number of production of particles by vegetation and the like, and that what particles there are, to great extent, come from biology in one way or another. There are two kinds of sources. One is what we call primary particles. Those are things that have been thrown in the atmosphere directly as particles. The other is what we call secondary particles. Those are particles that originate from the conversion of originally gaseous emissions that then are oxidized in the atmosphere and then condensed to particles.
So how did you actually determine that the particles you were observing in the Amazon were indeed biotic and not from some other source?
Well, it depends. What we call the primary biological particles, you actually can look at them with a microscope or an X-ray microscope also, as we did in our case, and you basically see morphologically the structures that are typical of, say, fungal spores or bacterial cells. So in those cases, it's obvious just from their morphology. For those small particles that don't have any distinctive morphology, we rely, A, sort of on the absence of other sources, just simply by virtue of the fact that we're so far away and the air has been washed out so much.
Mm-hmm.
And also, we have large emission of organic gases. Terpenes are classical, the sort of things that make, you know, lemons smell like lemons and oranges and so on. And then there is isoprene, a very common gas that's emitted out of plants.
Mm-hmm.
And these gases are oxidized in the atmosphere. They react with ozone. They react with the OH molecule radical. And then they become more oxidized and less volatile compounds. And then these less volatile compounds, they want to condense into droplets, into particles. And that's basically where our story with the potassium-rich particles comes in.
So, getting to this potassium, in your paper you point out that the majority of these aerosols contain potassium. What is the role of this potassium in the aerosols?
Well, let's start with something that totally surprised us. There is a classical phenomenon now that people have observed over and over in most forests of the world, even in cities, and that is that you have these explosions of small particles, and by small I mean particles of a size of a few nanometers, forming typically sort of in mid to late morning, and then growing successively into the sort of typical size of about 100 to 150 nanometers, which is something that we call nucleation events. So that typically has been explained by all these hydrocarbons that get oxidized in the forest and then they grow into particles. And the only place where we actually never observe that to occur is in the place where you think naively it would be most likely to occur, and that's in the biggest and most lush forest of the world, which is the Amazon, the tropical forest. And so we've been puzzling for a long time how actually do particles originate there and why are there no such nucleation events. And so what we're seeing now is that there's one key ingredient that's missing, which is necessary for these nucleation events, and that's actually sulfuric acid. But this has been studied most extensively in Finland. There's enough SO2, enough anthropogenic emissions, to produce sulfuric acid, and sulfuric acid sort of kicks off a chain of nucleation that then these organic particles succeed into and then grow up. In the Amazon, there's almost no sulfur in the atmosphere, and thus that catalytic event of sulfuric acid nucleation seems to be missing, and the organic vapors are looking for some other way to condense, and what they apparently do is they get hold of any surface that they can. And what they then find is these potassium-rich particles, which we postulate, I mean, this is something that needs still work and confirmation, that we postulate are emitted by the vegetation, specifically by fungi, and probably also by other leaf surfaces.
So what kind of impact can aerosols have on an environment?
Well, basically, the water cycle relies on clouds forming, and it's very important for the clouds what the number of particles is that's available for condensation as the air reaches the height where water becomes supersaturated and subsequently a cloud can form. If you form a cloud on very small number of particles, you get large droplets which can easily grow to raindrops. If you form a cloud on a very large number of particles, then the water has to be shared among all these particles. So the droplets are small and they have a difficult time to grow into raindrops. And then you get all sorts of different precipitation mechanisms. So in order to understand the starting point of the water cycle, really, cloud formation and rain formation, you really need to know what the mechanisms are that regulate the aerosol number concentrations. And that's basically sort of our key question, in addition to just the curiosity of actually wanting to know what actually makes up the atmosphere and how it works and functions.
So from an evolutionary standpoint, like how would animals kind of evolve to engineer their own climate?
Yeah, I mean, this gets you to the sort of Gaia-type discussion, and it's one of the things that's very difficult to argue from an evolutionary perspective. Of course, so it's similar to what we've been talked about with the claw hypothesis and the marine emission of dimethyl sulfide and particle production from the ocean from biogenic sulfur. Is this something that actually is a process that had some evolutionary control? I mean, is there a biosphere that sort of direct the properties of precipitation, and how can that be brought into accord with classical Darwinistic evolution? Or is it just something that just sort of an accidental byproduct of other evolutionary pressures that ended up just to be that way by whatever happenstance?
Yeah. So going into like climate models, are these sort of considerations taken into place when people are trying to predict rainfall or trying to understand how water cycles occur in areas like the Amazon or globally, how spore production or just these small particles are influencing where it's going to rain?
Well, I mean, the models, I think, are undergoing changes. Originally, people sort of always worked in their cloud microphysical models by saying, okay, well, over continents, there's always plenty of particles, so we don't need to worry about them. We just work with the assumption that they're sufficient. And so in the last few years, we've actually been able to show that indeed over continental areas, there aren't as many particles, at least in a pristine situation, as people had thought. But then most climate models still don't do a particularly explicit job at modeling these sort of things. And they certainly don't include these sort of particle generation processes in an active way. They would then just sort of prescribe and say, okay, over the Amazon forest, we have a particle concentration X, and so that's what it is, and not go into actually the mechanism of the production of these primary particles. And as a matter of fact, that whole issue of particle nucleation growth and growth into the CCN region is one where the people who construct aerosol models, which then could be incorporated into climate models, are still working quite a bit, and where a lot of the sort of classical assumptions actually are being challenged by things like what we've been doing here.
Great. So, Andy Andre, thanks for talking with me.
Thank you.
Meinrad Andre and colleagues report on potassium-based aerosols as seeds for clouds in the Amazon in this week's Science.
Humans have only known about antibiotics for about 70 years. Bacteria have known about them for millions. And some bacteria have evolved genes to help them survive antibiotic assault. I spoke with Kevin Forsberg about antibiotic-resistant bacteria found in the soil and how these organisms may act as a reservoir of resistance.
So what we show is that non-pathogenic soil-dwelling bacteria share the exact same antibiotic resistance genes that are common in many devastating bacterial pathogens. Now, when I say same exact resistance genes, what I mean is that the genes are exactly the same down to every last nucleotide. We describe examples of these shared resistance genes active against a broad spectrum of clinically important antibiotics covering five of the major drug classes. These resistance genes are found in a huge diversity of bacterial pathogens. Gram-negative and gram-positive organisms alike are found in every continent of the world and are often flanked by sequences that promote their movement between bacterial species, further facilitating their broad dissemination.
Okay, well, let's talk a little bit about that dissemination, some basic bacterial biology. Can you describe the way bacterial genes are both passed down but also around between different species or different members of the same species?
Of course. So just like every other living thing on the planet, bacteria are adept at replicating their DNA and passing their genes onto their offspring. Where bacteria are different and actually pretty impressive is that they are spectacularly proficient at sharing genes not only from progenitor to offspring, but also between species. Now, this horizontal exchange of genetic material can happen between incredibly unrelated bacteria, bacteria that are less alike than you are to your houseplants. This can happen via a number of mechanisms, exchange via plasmids, integrons, transposons, but the upshot is that bacterial populations possess incredible flexibility. If they don't have a gene or function necessary for survival in a given environment, they might survive and thrive nonetheless by borrowing a gene or genes from their neighbor. Accordingly, bacteria are often able to survive in a huge diversity of habitats, withstanding whatever nature or humans throw at them.
So if the bacteria can pass genes around this way between species and up and down generations, and they live everywhere, why did your group focus on soil as a reservoir for antibiotic resistance?
Well, for one, soil is incredibly diverse. It's teeming with all sorts of bacteria. We're talking billions of bacterial cells in 1 gram of soil. Mm-hmm. Second, it's believed that the natural production of antibiotics and the development of resistance to these compounds actually evolved in the soil. And thirdly, soil is exposed to an ever-increasing amount of antibiotics, often the same ones that are used clinically through predominantly their role in agriculture and rearing livestock.
So did you focus mainly on agricultural soils? What kinds did you look at?
We actually looked at multiple types of soils, so urban, forest, prairie, swamp, and farmland soils, 11 soil samples in all. Mm-hmm. And these soils not only came from different ecosystems, but actually from different parts of the country, Massachusetts, Pennsylvania, and Minnesota.
Interesting. Now, how did you get a good sample of resistant bacteria from these soils?
Well, we selected for them. Since we were only interested in those bacteria that were highly antibiotic resistant, we grew our samples in the presence of high concentrations of antibiotic, such that only those organisms able to tolerate the drugs would survive. Presumably, this would also enrich for those bacteria with antibiotic resistance genes, and we might better learn how these genes are being exchanged.
Okay. So after enriching the samples for these resistant bacteria, what were some of the similarities between the antibiotic-resistant bacteria from the soil and antibiotic-resistant pathogenic bacteria, the kind that can infect and harm people?
The most important thing we found was that non-pathogenic more or less harmless bacteria living in the soil, had antibiotic resistance genes with absolutely perfect nucleotide identity to resistance genes from really nasty human pathogens. And in fact, this perfect nucleotide identity didn't stop at just the resistance genes, but extended well beyond them into large swaths of intergenic non-coding DNA. Given the fact that mutations often occur as bacteria replicate, and that bacteria replicate incredibly quickly, the perfect conservation of nucleotide identity throughout long regions of DNA implies a relatively recent common origin. When the conservation also includes regions without putative function, for example, non-coding DNA that is more or less free from selection pressure, this point is even further emphasized. So, since the bacteria that share these resistance genes are unrelated, meaning they have a very different nucleotide makeup across their genome at large, we can identify the resistance genes, which have the exact same nucleotide makeup, as the outliers. This is how we know the resistance genes didn't evolve independently and separately in both the soil organisms and the pathogens, but rather come from the same source and have been exchanged between these populations relatively recently.
What you're saying is that, you know, you can have genes that have the same function, whereas they provide resistance, but they might not actually have the same sequence. But in this case, you showed they have identical or close to identical sequences and functions, so they've been exchanged or shared between the bacteria.
That's exactly right. The sequence of the resistance genes are identical, but they're in organisms that are very, very different. So we know that they've been shared between these organisms.
Well, did you find any new genes for resistance, ones where the function worked the same but the gene wasn't found anywhere else before?
Yeah. We found an example of a resistance gene that was entirely unrecognizable as a resistance gene based solely on nucleotide sequence.
Mm-hmm.
Yet, when we expressed this gene in a lab strain of E. coli, it was able to withstand large clinical doses of the antibiotic cycloserine.
What does it mean that we haven't seen this type of resistance before, but it's in a soil bacteria?
So the fact that we're finding resistance genes that we haven't seen before means simply there's more resistance out there. Just as we're trying to develop new antibiotics, bacteria likely have ways of resisting antibiotics that we haven't seen before. There's so much bacterial diversity out there, we've almost certainly undersampled the global reservoir of antibiotic resistance. Further work is going to be needed to more fully characterize the complement of resistance genes that are out there.
So what direction are these genes moving in? Are they going from the soil into pathogenic bacteria, or are they going in the other direction, or both?
So that's not exactly something this study is able to say, but we do know for certain that these genes are moving between non-pathogenic organisms and deadly human pathogens. As we continue to expose a large amount of antibiotics to both habitats, we're only increasing the likelihood of this exchange. However, the evidence we have can't distinguish the direction of gene flow.
Mm-hmm.
But if I had to guess, I'd guess it's happening in both directions.
Right. Well, how common is it for these types of genes to be passed between bacteria that typically don't interact with people and pathogenic bacteria?
So let me first point out that a lot of bacteria that are more or less harmless can interact with people without actually causing infection.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, the majority of bacteria that interact with you are non-pathogenic. They don't make you sick. But this question really hits at a great point, one that we would be really interested in addressing, but one, again, that these experiments can't exactly speak to.
Mm-hmm.
We looked at a relatively small number of soils and don't have the statistical power to say how common the exchange is or which soils are most likely to participate in the exchange. However, with the computational pipeline that we've developed, we are now poised to take on experiments of much larger scales that are aimed at answering these questions, but we don't really have that information today.
So I guess I really want to get at the point of why is this happening? Why are bacteria in the soil that aren't really necessarily affected by antibiotics, you know, gathering these genes or serving as a reservoir for antibiotic resistance?
So I've hinted at this, but really bacteria are acquiring a higher prevalence of resistance genes and trading resistance genes simply because they have reason to do so. More and more antibiotics are being exposed to organisms in both the soil and clinic, and bacteria have more and more reason to need resistance genes. I think a lot of people have a good intuition for this when it comes to clinical use, but I think people are surprised by the level of resistance in the environment.
Right.
Upwards of 80% of antibiotics by weight are used in animal feeds to promote growth, and these antibiotics end up in the surrounding environment, including the soil, and we've observed increasing levels of resistance in soil microbial communities. We see more resistance in the soil, more resistance in pathogens, and we now know these groups can exchange resistance genes.
So is this something that we can prevent? Is there a way to prevent the buildup of antibiotic-resistant genes in the soil?
Can we entirely prevent it? No. Bacteria develop resistance well before humans existed, and they've been trading genes for likely even longer.
Mm-hmm.
But what we can do is diminish the problem by giving bacteria less reason to have these antibiotic resistance genes. The fact soil bacteria and human pathogens exchange resistance genes means that our treatment of one group is likely to have an effect on the other.
Mm-hmm.
If we increase the amount of resistance genes in, say, soil organisms by exposing them to large amounts of antibiotics through animal use, we're likely to witness an increase in resistance genes in human pathogens, making them harder to kill. The opposite is also probably true. If soil organisms are acquiring pathogenic resistance genes, this might mean more soil bacteria will be able to thrive in a hospital setting, and one day might decide humans would make a pretty nice host. Essentially, bacteria are conspiring among one another, trading resistance genes as antibiotic exposure becomes more prevalent. If we want to curb this trend, a great place to start is with more prudent use of antibiotics.
Great. Well, Kevin Forsberg, thanks so much for talking with me.
Thanks for talking with me.
Kevin Forsberg and colleagues write about a safe harbor for antibiotic resistance genes in a report this week in Science.
Though the dinosaur reserve in Jurassic Park, based on 65-million-year-old DNA, may be far-fetched, scientists are reaching further and further back in time to examine ancient genes. In a scientific milestone, researchers have developed a means of sequencing ancient DNA with extremely high precision. The test subject? A Denisovan girl, who lived in Siberia roughly 60 to 80,000 years ago. Contributing correspondent Ann Gibbons spoke with Carrie Klein about how the team did it and what their findings can tell us about human origins.
The exciting breakthrough is that researchers have sequenced the genome of an ancient girl. She was a different kind of human, an archaic human, who lived in a cave in Siberia more than 50,000 years ago. And they managed, from a tiny little piece of bone, less than the size of like a child's baby aspirin, to get the DNA and to sequence it to the quality that's as good as modern human DNA genomes. So we have this spectacularly clear sequence, the complete genome of this archaic kind of human, even though we only have three tiny fossils, a tiny piece of pinky finger bone and two teeth. So we have this genome in search of a fossil record, yet we know more about this girl and her people than we do about Neanderthals, for whom we have thousands of fossils.
Now, this is a topic that is not unfamiliar to readers of Science magazine. In fact, about a year ago, you and I were talking about this very cave, Denisova, in Siberia, and about these particular fossils that were found there. So tell me about the chain of events that has happened in this year since we first talked about this.
Yes. Well, first the fossils were found, and research has gone on in about four different fronts. There's a team based in Leipzig at the Max Planck Institute that has a mixture of geneticists and anthropologists working with archaeologists in the field all over the world, but particularly in Russia. So the first thing they're doing is working with scientists to try to find more fossils of the Denisovans, and they're off in places like Mongolia with collaborations trying to see if they can actually find more of these enigmatic, mysterious people who were closely related to Neanderthals, but they weren't Neanderthals and they weren't modern humans. So who were these people? We have a hint that they were out there in Asia, and we want to know who they were. The second area of research is to get more DNA from the fossils, and that's where this paper falls. That is to improve the methods for taking the DNA that we do have and getting more information out of it. The other two areas were to find more ancient DNA, to go out and look at fossils that were alive at the same time as this Denisovan girl and try to get DNA from fossils that we haven't been able to get DNA from before to compare their genomes.
Mm-hmm.
And then finally, to follow up, as we read these genomes of these archaic people and identify differences in their genetic material from ours, what do those differences, those mutations in their DNA code for? You know, what makes us a human? By reading the Denisovan genome so carefully, by looking at this other girl's DNA, we can find out the genetic recipe for what makes us human.
Hmm.
We can see how our ancestors' DNA changed. That's what Svante Paabo said. That was his term, the genetic recipe for being a modern human. So that's very exciting, but right now when we read the code, we don't know what most of those differences in DNA actually code for.
Right. Well, let's start first with the methodology. So in your article, you highlight, you know, all sorts of issues with sequencing old DNA. So it can become degraded. The two strands can sometimes become separated. So how was this team able to finally sequence such old genetic material?
Yes, okay. So they got a piece of bone that was the size of a fingernail sliver initially from the lab in Germany at the Max Planck, Santé Pabo's lab, got one piece of bone, and luckily for them, there wasn't a lot of bacteria contaminating the sample, because if you get bacteria, you end up with lots of copies of the bacterial DNA, but not the individual's DNA. So this was an amazingly pure piece of bone sample, so they were able to get really good results. But the first genome they published in 2010 was low coverage. What that meant is they read many of the sites, but they missed so many of the nucleotide sites that it wasn't a very accurate read of the genome. Hmm. So what they have done since then is they realized most of the really exciting high-throughput sequencing methods that are used for the human genome studies require that when you prepare the DNA for these automatic sequencing machines, that you have double-stranded DNA. As you know, our DNA comes in a double helix, right? So in living humans' DNA, the DNA is still in that double helix form. But with ancient DNA, most of the DNA is fragmentary and degraded, and it's got all these little single strands flapping around. All that was lost in the initial efforts to sequence the genome because they just couldn't put it into the sequencers. So what this graduate student, actually is a postdoc in Svante Pabo's lab, did, this is Matthias Meyer, 3 years ago he set out to come up with a new method from scratch where you take a single strand of DNA and prepare that for the sequencers. It wasn't a brand new idea. Other people have tried to do it, but it was very hard to do because it requires many steps to prepare the DNA. But he stuck with it, and lo and behold, he found first cave bear DNA that he got all these copies, and then by sticking with it, he eventually got amazing coverage of the genome. And so they got as many as 31 copies of the genome, which gives them an incredibly crystal clear copy of this girl's genome. And that's what's so exciting, because it's a very precise read, so they're not looking at mistakes.
Well, so what does all this tell us about the Denisovans and how they relate to us today in the 21st century?
Well, one thing that we got from this is a catalog of changes, that genetic recipe for being human. But about the Denisovans, before we talk about what made us human, we found out, for example, that they had a very small population for a long time. By having such an accurate genome, we're able to calculate how long ago their ancestors split from the ancestors of ours. The ancestors of Denisovans and Neanderthals, who were more closely related to each other, split from the ancestor of modern humans. They began to split about 800,000 years ago in Africa. Now, it was a long process, and the populations probably finished up splitting, oh, maybe 200,000 years ago to 400,000, 500,000 years ago. They're not real sure about that. Hmm. All the populations were small initially, but then modern humans' populations got a lot bigger. The Denisovans didn't. They were always small, and they stayed small all the way till the time this girl was alive, perhaps because they were living in a colder climate with all the glaciers coming in and out of Europe and Asia. The other thing that's interesting is they were able, with this clear genome, to date precisely how long ago this girl was alive. And that's exciting because they were able to see that when they mapped the differences in her DNA compared to ours, that her line was shorter. If you were to map this on a family tree, there was missing evolution. Her branch on the tree was shorter than our branch. And that meant she was probably alive around somewhere between 60,000 and 80,000 years ago. Now, they're putting some question marks around that date because it's based on some other research that tells us the mutation rate, how quickly mutations arise in the genome. But that is older than what the dates were from the fossil record. So this suggests that her people were around earlier. And then we also have learned what she looked like a little bit more. So one thing that's interesting is she had brown hair, brown eyes, and brown skin. Hmm. That doesn't mean all the Denisovans did, but she did. And then we have a whole catalog of changes, some hot genes that changed between Denisovans and us. And those genes include 8 genes that were associated with the wiring of the brain and the nervous system.
Hmm.
They're involved with the growth of axons and dendrites. There's one gene that's associated with autism. There's another gene called the FOXP2 gene. There's one that's a regulator of the FOXP2 gene. When that gene has problems, there are language disorders in families in Pakistan that have been studied. So Svante Pabo, when he talks about this, says, you know, it's tempting to speculate that crucial aspects of our synaptic transmission, of the way our brains are wired, changed in modern humans.
So what's next here? What new research avenues do you think will come out of this study?
many research avenues. Probably one of the most exciting is to follow up these mutations, these changes in genes, to do tissue expression studies, to find out what this gene does that regulates the FOXP2 gene in language, to find out what the genes that seem to be involved in wiring do, what specifically are the differences that made us human. So what needs to be done is tissue expression studies, ways to really nail down what that DNA codes for. Mm. Also, exciting work to see how widespread Denisovan and Neanderthal DNA is in living humans. Do any Africans have it? So far, we have little hints that some East Africans may have it. We're not sure, and what does that mean to the models of how it spread? Also, looking for fossils. Where are the Denisovans? You know, this is like, mm-hmm. Where's Waldo? Where are these missing people? That's an exciting area of work that we should be watching as well.
Do you think that now that we have this technique of sequencing single-stranded DNA, that there will be a race to use this technique on even older fossils?
It's going to move the field forward. However, it's still very expensive to use. Mm. If you're sequencing one sample from an ancient human, it's worth the money. And so I think anybody who can find ancient DNA from a human ancestor or member of our family will try to use this method. 3 years ago, no one would have predicted that this would work, and the advances in preparing DNA for sequencing are moving at such a rapid rate that it may just take off.
Great. Well, hopefully in another couple of months, we'll be talking about this again. So, Anne Gibbons, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Anne Gibbons writes about Denisovan DNA in a news article this week. You can also find the research article documenting the result by Matthias Meyer and colleagues online at www.scienceexpress.org.
Finally today, we have David Grimm, online news editor of Science, here to give us a rundown of some of the recent stories from our online daily news site. I'm Isabel Bunny. So, David, the researchers in our first study for today were studying chimpanzees and found a wide range of intelligence levels. What did they make of this?
Well, Isabel, we know obviously in human society that we have a pretty wide range of intelligence. There are some of us that are maybe not so bright. And then, of course, we've got individuals like Tesla and Einstein that are really sort of at the top of the heap. And the question is, do other animals sort of show the same range of intelligence that we do? And to do this today, the researchers actually looked at a group of chimpanzees, some of whom lived in sanctuaries in Africa, others that lived in a zoo, others that lived in captivity in Germany. And they really sort of, they tested them on a lot of different tests. In one experiment, they asked the chimpanzees to find food in a container after it had sort of been shuffled around with empty containers. In another experiment, the chimpanzees had to use a stick to get food placed on a high platform. So sort of test to see whether they could sort of intuit how to figure out different situations. And what they saw is sort of something that you'd probably see in humans too, was that there was a really big variation in how the chimps performed on these tests. Some of them did better on some, and some of them did better on others. But there was one individual, this female chimp named Natasha, who really sort of blew all the other chimps away.
So you talked a little bit about the different sorts of tests administered to these apes. How reliable were individual intelligence tests? So how predictive of other measures of intelligence were they?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, humans, we have this IQ test, which is somewhat controversial, but people say, you know, the higher you score on this IQ test, the more intelligent you are. The researchers didn't really find that for the chimpanzees. They found that, you know, chimps performed well on one test, they didn't necessarily perform well on another. So there wasn't one test they could give them and say, this chimpanzee is smarter than this other chimpanzee. But with Natasha, she really excelled so much at all of the tests that the researchers could reliably say that, you know, if you want to use the word smart, she was sort of a lot smarter than all the other chimps. She was sort of the Einstein of the group.
What has this study taught us about intelligence in general?
Well, basically what it tells us is, first of all, that, you know, there is a range of intelligence in other animals, at least in chimpanzees, the same sort of range we see in humans. Although, obviously, chimpanzees aren't going to be necessarily good at the same things that we're good at. So just because we give a chimpanzee a math test doesn't mean that because the chimpanzee fails that test that the chimpanzee isn't smart, just because chimpanzees don't usually use math in their daily lives like we do. You know, the trick with trying to determine the intelligence of an individual is to try to design tests that are really specific to them, which is why the researchers had them doing tests where they were trying to find food or trying to sort of intuit where a treat might be, something analogous to something they might have to do in the wild.
From smart apes to hungry monkeys, our next study covers the effects of a special diet called calorie restriction on the health of rhesus macaques. But let's back up a bit.
So what are some of the benefits for different species that have been found for this sort of diet?
Well, Isabel, there is something known as the calorie restriction hypothesis. And the idea is pretty simple. The less you eat, the longer you live. And it's actually been shown, as you alluded to, in a number of species, mice, some worms that are given a lot less to eat actually live a lot longer. But the findings haven't been replicated in humans, and it's been really hard to test this. These animals, like mice or worms, have lifespans of sometimes days, with mice maybe a few months or a couple years. So it's relatively easy to run experiments where you can look at the entire life of an animal and see, okay, if we fed this animal 25% less food, does it live, you know, maybe a few months longer? But humans obviously have such big lifespans, it would be really hard to do this study with people. So in this new study, they turned to rhesus monkeys, which are related to us, a lot more related at least than mice or worms are, but have a much shorter lifespan. The average lifespan for rhesus monkeys is about 27 years. And the results of the study with one group of monkeys came out in 2009, where researchers showed that monkeys living at the Wisconsin National Primate Research Center that ate a lot less than control monkeys seemed to live a lot longer. 13% of the calorie-restricted monkeys had died from old age versus 37% of the control animals. So there really seemed to be this sort of significant effect of calorie restriction.
So this study looked at two different groups of monkeys in Wisconsin and Maryland, respectively. Were there any differences found between the two groups?
Right. Well, there was another group of monkeys that was also being studied. This group lived at the National Institutes of Health Animal Center in Dickerson, Maryland. And the researchers conducted very similar experiments with these monkeys. They fed some of the monkeys a lot less than others. What was interesting about this study was in this study, the calorie-restricted monkeys did not seem to live longer. One similarity between the two studies is that in both the Maryland and the Wisconsin groups, the monkeys that ate less seemed to have a higher quality of life. They had less cardiovascular disease. They also had much less incidence of developing cancer. And that was also true of the Maryland group. So even though the Maryland calorie-restricted monkeys weren't living longer, they seemed to be living at least better than their counterparts that were eating a lot more calories.
Okay, so is there still room for optimism about potentially expanding longevity?
There is. And in fact, some experts point to some differences between these two studies. They say that the Wisconsin group of monkeys were actually not eating as healthy of a diet. And in fact, they were eating a diet that was high in processed food and refined sugar. And obviously, the monkeys that weren't calorie restricted were eating a lot more of this. And that could explain the differences in lifespan, whereas the Maryland monkeys were on a much healthier diet. So there could still be a cause for optimism. It could mean that in humans, it's not just sort of reducing the calories that we eat, but actually eating healthier food as well. Again, though, we were just talking about monkeys. These studies haven't really been done in humans, although there is a study that's currently ongoing that has tried calorie restriction in humans, and the results of that are actually going to be coming out pretty soon. So we should know in the fairly near future whether a calorie-restricted diet actually has benefits for humans in addition to the benefits it's already been shown to have for mice, worms, and monkeys.
Good to know. Now, this next study turned the tables on researchers, making them the subjects. So what was this study exactly about?
Well, this study is kind of a fun one. It's about what researchers' faculty webpages say about them. If you go to any university website and look for a scientist, chances are you'll not only see their bio and their CV on the page, but you'll also see a picture of them. It turns out there's some differences in pictures. Some faculty members tend to have their left cheek facing the camera. Some have their right cheek facing the camera. And this study was trying to figure out, is there any meaning behind that? Are these faculty members consciously or unconsciously presenting something about their personality to the rest of us?
So what is significant about the left side of the face?
Darwin postulated that emotions are stronger on the left side of the face. They actually sort of begin on the left side of the face, and they're actually expressed more on the left side of the face. So if somebody was unhappy, you maybe have a better time being able to register that by looking at their left side of their face than the right side. And actually, it sort of makes sense from a neuroscience point of view, because the nerves on the left side of the face are actually controlled by the right side of our brain, which has also been linked to the processing of facial expression. So it all sort of adds up to this idea that if you're looking at the left side of somebody's face, you're seeing sort of maybe more of their emotional side, whereas maybe if you're looking at the right side, you're seeing maybe more of their rational, non-emotional side.
So how did the researchers conduct their study to determine whether the left-facing bias was consistent or true?
Well, yeah, that was really the question. You know, do faculty present one side or the other of their face to the camera, and what does that say about how they want to be viewed by the world, either consciously or unconsciously? The idea would be that if a faculty member is presenting the left side of their face, maybe they want people to think they're more emotional, maybe more sensitive. And if they're presenting the right side of their face, maybe they want the public to think they're more calm, they're more rational, they're less emotional. They're more, as we say in our headline, a little bit more like Mr. Spock on Star Trek. And actually, that's what the researchers found. They scanned almost 6,000 faces from 30 university websites around the world. And they found that faculty members in the sciences, in engineering and mathematics field were significantly more likely to show the left side of their face than the right side of their face in these faculty pictures, whereas their colleagues in the arts and humanities were statistically more likely to show the right side of their face, which again gets back to this idea that maybe faculty members want to show themselves as more cool and rational, and maybe the arts and humanities folks want to show themselves as more emotional.
So are there any unanswered questions left, or what further research should be done?
Well, one expert says that, you know, there's still really no evidence that just even if faculty members are purposely or unpurposely showing these different sides of their faces to the world, whether we're actually registering that as differences in their personality. In other words, if I see the faculty page of a scientist who's presenting her right cheek to the camera, do I automatically think, well, hey, she seems a lot more serious, a lot less emotional? Or is that just sort of a hypothesis on the part of these researchers and it's actually not really the case? So a little bit more research needs to be done to see not only how do faculty members present themselves to the world, but how do the rest of us actually react to the way that these people are facing the camera?
All right, David. Now, what are some of the other recent stories on our online daily news site?
Well, Isabel, for Science Now, we've got a story about using dogs to scare pigeons away on beaches and how that could improve public health. Also got a story about weighing individual molecules with a mechanically vibrating beam. For Science Insider, our policy blog, we've got a story about how stem cell research is faring in U.S. courts. Also a story about how President Obama is interacting with science teachers across the country. Finally, we are back in business with Science Live, our weekly chat on the hottest topics in science. Next week's Science Live is going to be about the impact of brain injury on cognition and how that might play into sports and the military. So be sure to check out all these stories on the site.
Thank you, David.
Thanks, Isabel.
David Grimm is the online news editor for Science. You can check out the latest news on the policy blog Science Insider at news.sciencemag.org, where you can also join a live chat, Science Live, on the hottest science topics every Thursday at 3 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time.
And that concludes the August 31st, 2012 edition of the Science Podcast.
If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org.
The show is a production of Science Magazine. Jeffrey Cook composed the music. I'm Edward Hermy.
And I'm Sarah Crespi. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, AAAS, thanks for joining us.